Hello, I'm Mark Steiner.
And I'm Anthony McCarthy.
It's Monday. So we are together once again, and we have a couple of interesting hours ahead of us. We're going to talk about sexting on that many people, not just young people are doing it everywhere, but how it affects young people, how Facebook is affecting young people, how bullying on the web is affecting young people.
Social media really has changed the way so many things happen.
It has. Mm-hmm. And the younger kids respond to it in a different way than adults, and social media is having a deep effect on our kids' minds, on our society. We'll talk about that with four very interesting guests over the course of this next hour. And then we talk to Aliza Gebb, Stephen David, and Tabit Abdullah. At least one of the two of them have very different ideas from the other one about what's going on in the Middle East. All that and more. But first, we have to turn this over to WEAA Traffic. Check on the roads, and we'll be right back. So please stay with us.
Support for WEAA is provided by Garmin, makers of the Garmin Nuvi GPS personal navigator, many offering real-time traffic alerts in most metro areas.
Hello, I'm Mark Steiner.
And I'm Anthony McCarthy.
There was an article in the New York Times on Sunday about sexting in a particular case that took place that was very sad. This young girl, Marguerite, who posted a picture of herself nude to send to her boyfriend. She was in the eighth grade. They broke up. He sent it to a girl.
He sent it to another person.
Who was now in a dispute with the young girl whose picture it was, and all of a sudden it went viral. And in some states, this is in terms of prosecution. Some states, it's people don't know how to handle it, what to do about it. But that and what we've talked about before in this air and bullying, there was a report on National Public Radio this morning about Facebook and the problems with Facebook and young people and the friend thing on Facebook can be more deeply painful for young people than being left out of the table in the lunchroom. We'll get a little bit deeper into all that. And I think that, you know, we all have kids, and some of us out here listening are kids. Some people accuse me of still being a kid sometimes. So, and I think that this new technology has many, many ways exacerbated normal human interaction and feelings and emotions, and especially for our young people. So what's the response to all that? We have with us once again Zeynep Tufekci, who is assistant professor at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology. And her blog is www.technosociology.org. And Dana Boyd, a fellow at Harvard University's Beekman Center for Internet and Security and a social media researcher at Microsoft, who was quoted in the article in the New York Times. And Zeynep and Dana, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Good to be here. Thanks for inviting me. And hello, Dana.
I understand you two know each other.
Yes.
That's a good start. When we think about this, and folks who want to join us out here, 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888, because it's a deeply troubling subject, one that we're just beginning to come to grips with in terms of what this technology is doing to kind of alter behaviors, intensifying behaviors. And it's really confusing for both parents and children, I think, on how to deal with it. And Dana, would you say it's fair to say that, I mean, as a culture, we have yet to be able to put our Paleolithic minds around what this new technology is doing with us?
Well, I think the part of it is that we're focusing on the technology rather than looking at some of the underlying practices, right? The idea that kids are exploring their sexuality is not actually new.
No, that's not new.
They're doing it in a mediated form is, but it's not really the technology that's radically changing the practice. It's radically changing the visibility of the practice.
So now, to take that one step further, what does that mean to you?
Well, so part of it is that, you know, the idea of young people trying to figure out who they are, trying to flirt and socialize and try to make sense of their relationships with other people, we've always done that. And technology has now found its way into teenagers' hands, and they're sitting here and using it to do that exploration. What's challenging is that we now have records of that exploration in the form of, you know, digital records. And not only that, you can actually spread that information in totally new ways. And this is what we see about young people having photographs of one another and spreading them. And there are serious consequences to this because we have laws that were set up with different kinds of expectations. Right? So one of the challenges about this is that we keep coming into child pornography laws. And child pornography laws are really set up for very good reason to prosecute people to the full extent of the law when they have a photographic depiction of a sex crime against a minor. Right, but the fact that we now are saying teenagers can sort of figure out their sexuality but can't have these photographs of it or else they're violating the law, we're running into these places where the law and social norms really conflict.
This is Anthony McCarthy. Zeynep, I'm curious about so many messages are sent out to young people about being careful with what you send. So, I mean, I've just over the last month and a half on the Today Show, they've had segment after segment where they try to educate young people. In particular, these segments tend to be about young people on this issue. But profiles like we read in the New York Times continue to happen. I'm wondering, is it that young people don't see it as much of a taboo as someone a little bit older? I'm much younger than Mark, but that someone may see it differently, this idea of sending a nude picture or a sexually provocative picture just doesn't hold the same meaning to young people as it does maybe someone a little bit older.
Well, I think what is happening is kind of the building on what Dana was saying is that people, kids, young people, adolescents, used to do this too. I mean, it's before digital media became this widespread.
Used to do what?
They used to share risky pictures when they had means to take pictures, or, you know, it's one of the...
With a Polaroid or something.
With a Polaroid or through camera. So that's not... Or, you know, being engaged in whatever is kind of a way of just exploring their sexuality. I totally agree. That's not, you know, it's not new. It's just something that, for some reason, adults, as soon as they're out of that stage, they seem to pretend it never happened, the way we don't seem to talk about what happened in middle school once we're out of it, or high school once we're in college. It's just this kind of, you know, adult amnesia of what it was like to be an adolescent. That's part of the problem. But what is a significant difference that I can see is that this kind of exploration always had downsides and upsides, and it's a kind of way of finding yourself in the world, but now can create consequences that may follow these kids around for many years. One aspect of is what Dana pointed out, which is they may be prosecuted through really draconian laws not intended for this purpose. But, you know, besides the legal repercussions, that particular story shows the ease with which this particular photograph spread from one person to one school to every place else. And I mean, it's quite possible that photograph from, you know, that girl's 13-year-old self is going to follow her around through high school, maybe beyond. I mean, it's kind of hard to put that genie back in the bottle. So I think that's a major issue. Now, in terms of the Today Show or other things, I think part of the reason they don't work the way it's set up is there's a lot of alarmist rhetoric that conflates the issues between the fact that it's normal for teenagers to explore their sexuality versus the kind of risks of, you know, digital sharing, putting something in a digital format, sending it around. I mean, you need to not appear alarmist to kids, and that's also a problem with some of the drug education approaches we've seen. They were so exaggerated that they lost credibility. So I'm all for, you know, literacy, information technology literacy being part of school curriculum, you know, being part of something that parents can talk to kids about. But it has to be done the right way. I just don't see when I talk to, you know, I usually talk to college students, not necessarily the adolescent, the teenage age group. I don't really see them less concerned with privacy, but sometimes they find themselves in really hard to fathom circumstances because something they've done all of a sudden becomes, you know, they become like a little celebrity in their school or something, just completely unexpected. And that can be hard for a kid to deal with, especially if it's over something like in this case, naked pictures that is embarrassing and difficult to deal with for a teenager.
Let's also be clear that actually teenagers are not doing this at a higher rate than adults. Pew Internet and the American Life Project found that actually adults are more likely to sex than young people. So there's also this interesting mixed message, right, where young people are, you know, getting a lot of flack for this, where adults are actually doing this, celebrities are doing it and getting a lot of attention for it. There's songs being written about sexting, and I'm interviewing teenagers who are grossed out by the fact that their parents are doing this and they're finding this on their phone. Right? So the thing is that this is a story that in many ways is about teen sexuality as separated from adult sexuality. And it's one of those stories of, you know, do what I say, not what I do. And that's complicating the ability to get out a serious message about, you know, what it means. The other thing is that we're in an environment of, you know, abstinence-only education. We're in an environment where we're telling young people don't have sex, and yet the repercussions for taking these sexual images are often at a higher level. The other thing is, as Zainab said, which I think is totally right on, the shame issues that are around us are often the much more real experiences that young people face, not necessarily the legal repercussions.
You both said a lot in the last few minutes. I just want to kind of maybe, Anthony, I kind of parse through it a little bit. I mean, I don't want to spend a great deal of time on, but what you said earlier, Zainab, about this is, you know, people getting old and forgetting what it was like to be a teenager. I think in some ways that's true. However, it does seem to me that the technology that we work and play with now changes the way we do everything.
I'm not disagreeing. The technology complicates how to navigate those somewhat treacherous waters. But what I'm sort of trying to point out is they're doing what teenagers have always done. And so we don't have a new kind of teenager on our hands that we've never had before. They're kind of like us when we were teenagers, maybe not, you know, exactly you or exactly me, but they're whatever they are in their own way. But yes, absolutely, the technological changes do complicate the particular challenges they face. And this kind of the ease with which negative information can spread or embarrassing information can spread absolutely complicates them, and I do think we have a responsibility to try to help them deal with this new world, because it's kind of a weird thing to imagine, oh, I'm going to send this picture, and it's now, it could possibly go everywhere. That's not what a teenager's thinking. They're just thinking, they see it as an interaction between them, and in this case, the girl in question saw it as an interaction between herself and this boy she was interested in, and it's the step from that to this is going to get me in the New York Times and is going to unleash all this. I mean, there's no reason to assume that a 13-year-old will just easily and automatically be able to assess that consequence, which, of course, doesn't happen all the time either. I mean, the kids do this and without this kind of repercussion all the time. So once in a while, this is what happens. But a lot of times, it's just, you know, there.
I find it interesting that with the instantaneous nature of our technology, I mean, say I were to be interested in a girl and I took a Polaroid of myself when I was in high school and maybe a provocative Polaroid and I put it in a letter and I was going to hand it to her in school. I actually had time to think about that and the consequence of that, or maybe not. I don't know. But it may be that gap in time was the saving grace in keeping me from giving her that letter. Whereas when you take a picture with your phone and you hit send, it's gone. And there is no buffer between that act and the consequence because it's really instantaneous.
But yet, in some ways, it really isn't. I mean, one of my favorite parts about talking to young people is actually the amount of effort that they will put into crafting the perfect message to look really casual and like it was written really quickly. Right? And you ask them about why will you do this? Why do you spend 2 hours writing the perfect, you know, 100 and, you know, something character text message? And they were like, well, I can't approach her in face-to-face because I'd have to do it real-time and I would really embarrass myself. So here I get to do this sort of thought process that becomes really powerful, but I have to make it look like it's casual because if I don't, then I look really lame. So you know, each of these technologies has different affordances around time. Face-to-face only allows for certain things, right? Mediated environments, like the idea of taking an object and giving an object, is a very different kind of temporal rhythm. But even the digital one, which appears instantaneous because the process of send and received is relatively close to that, the process of going through and curating and really thinking about what you say isn't necessarily instantaneous. And this is the sort of value of it being semi-synchronous. You know, it's not quite synchronous. It's not the same as face-to-face. And young people are actually trying to understand the affordances and trying to make them work for themselves. Do they mess up? Sure. Do adults mess up? Of course. We've all sent emails where we're like, oh, I didn't mean for that to go out. But part of it is this process of really learning and really managing those tempos.
410-319-8888. Anthony McCarthy and I are joined here for this first affordable program. As I'm up to Fekian, you just heard Dana Boyd. And later on the program, we'll be joined by Aaron Ryan and Susanna Stern as we examine what's going on with sexting and Facebook and young people and the issues being raised and the law that people are trying to wrestle with and how it changes our phenomenon in our culture. 410-319-8888. We have a caller who's coming in. We'll get to those calls in just a minute. Just one this quick question, and we'll open the phones right away at 410-319-8888. But it seems to me, and maybe I'm missing something here, but it seems to me, or maybe I obsess on this too much, but that the technology itself, it not just speeds up, enhances, and changes what we may think of as regular behavior. I mean, teenagers, young people, human beings have always been obsessed with sex, with attracting somebody else, with being able to attract another human being. But this seems to heighten it in ways that changes our own behavior. You know, I mean,
let me try to say, I mean, I don't disagree that it changes things, but for example, there's historically a lot of examples of teenage boys displaying their sort of how brave they are through things that in hindsight are bordering on the stupid side too. And if you can see, like in Turkey, where I'm originally from, there are these islands in the Marmara Sea, some of which have cliffs that you can jump into the sea. So teenage boys would sort of make a show of how brave they were by jumping into the sea from these really high cliffs. Now, this requires very low tech. Now, if you put motorcycles into the equation, right, kind of a couple of seconds, and then they can do that on motorcycles, and then they can ride without helmets. But you're sort of seeing the same kind of mechanism. They're displaying this, you know, look how brave I am. And in hindsight, it has its risk and it's kind of reckless, but it's also part of being human. So, yes, you have new rules if it's a motorcycle versus jumping off from a cliff.
Zainab's point is really important here because it's not just, you know, what they will potentially lose, but what they will potentially gain. Right, so risky behaviors are risks because there's a potential outcome that you want. Whether it's managing to send a photo and flirt with a girl and she responds positively to you, whether it's a matter of being able to get a certain kind of achieved status where you're like, I'm really cool because I did this thing. People have these goals that they you know, the ideas of what they could imagine that are positive happening. And that's part of the process. And we tend to hear about the stories when everything went wrong, right? When it's seriously negative. And it's horrifying. But part of it is that when we think about combating these issues, you can't just imagine all that's wrong when you also have to hold up to light why people do it because of what the things that they gain are.
Dana, let me ask you before we go to the phones, very quickly about this idea. Mark and I both use social media to promote our programs and make sure that we stay in touch with our listeners and, you know, and it's amazing to me that although I have not met many of the people I interact with on the internet, whether it's on Facebook or tweeting or whatever, they feel a certain level of intimacy with me and I with them, almost to the point where we are friends. And I mean, my father passed away over the weekend and I posted it.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I posted it early this morning. More than 100 messages posted to Facebook with condolences. It's almost like this social media has changed. It really has changed how we interact with each other or the level of I'm at a loss of words. I'm not sure why. It really seems like it has made us more intimate than we in fact are.
So scholars have long had this concept called parasocial relations.
Yeah.
And the idea is that I can follow the detail of Angelina Jolie's life and she doesn't have to know that I exist, right? And I can feel like she's my close friend without getting any feedback from her whatsoever. What social media in some ways does is it provides a possibility of that feedback loop, right? In theory, Angelina could pay attention to me and just say one or two words and I feel like I'm even more connected to her, right? Which is part of the dynamic that you have with your fans. The thing is that these relationships that you broker are really powerful and really, you know, empowering for certain things. But not just anybody can achieve that, right? Part of it is that you're able to leverage a certain amount of status mm-hmm. from, you know, your role as a journalist, your role as you know, on the radio, to actually acquire an audience who will pay attention to you and will be there for you for certain things. This is not necessarily true in both directions. And so you might be able to be responding to your fans in particular ways, but you're not going to necessarily be there for all of their emotional hardships. And so one of the challenges in working through all of these dynamics is how do we deal with these unequal power relation dynamics, which are very particular to the kinds of social media that allow us to scale, that allow us to feel like we can be connected to the masses, but may also make you feel very lonely if people are not responding back to you. Right? And they allow for certain kinds of opportunities. You can get advice and you can get certain things, but they may not allow for other things, right? These may not be the people that are holding your hand over the weekend as you're going through your own struggles, right? So there's all of these ways in which there's different kinds of intimacies, and that it's not about it replacing or eliminating other kinds of intimacies as much as it's a complementary process, right? You get some things from this and some things that you get from certain kinds of other interactions, et cetera, et cetera. But it's also important to realize that what you're experiencing because of your role and because of your status is not the same as what young people are necessarily experiencing when they're interacting almost exclusively with their peers. And it's a very different kind of social dynamic.
And most of them interact offline, online, you know, kind of semi-seamlessly. You know, it's the people who are part of their online lives, they don't, I'm from my interviews, I rarely find people, there is some segment, but I rarely find people interacting solely through online. It's always like people they know, and it's just one more way of communicating with them most of the time.
Let me open the phones and let listeners join this conversation as we explore this world that, again, this New York Times story that exploded onto the scene on Sunday about sexting and what happened with young people there. We haven't covered the laws yet and how the laws have not caught up with technology or real human behavior in many ways. And we'll talk about that and look at many other issues surrounding this. And the NPR story this morning about Facebook and youth depression, 410-319-8888. Leo, you're on the air.
Yes. Good evening, Mark.
Good evening, Leo.
Anthony.
Good evening, Leo.
And you have my condolences, Anthony.
Thank you very much.
Praise God. Listen, very briefly, we're on a runaway train technologically, and that's always going to be the case. Unless we can incorporate a kind of legal mandate that that requires an environmental impact statement of sorts, an evaluative instrument with regard to technology. What I'm trying to say in this instance and others is that before we make any given technology saleable, because, you know, we're going to sell it to the public, whether it occurs every 4 months or every 6 months. It always occurs, and it's rapidly. It outruns our ability to sometimes to comprehend and utilize it in a constructive way. We're going to have to kind of put the brakes on long enough to evaluate the impact that it's going to have on people, as opposed to the prime directive, which from an industrial point of view is money-making. Folks want to make money, but I understand. But we've got to balance the money-making that comes out of technology with the reality of how it affects our lives in terms of our morality, our ethics, and all the other kinds of things that I'm hearing you discuss. This is a fascinating and exciting discussion, but I'm not hearing that we have to rein it in, at least to the extent that we have some type of evaluative instrument that is put in place before we buy it, before we utilize it, how it affects our lives.
Okay.
We've got to do that.
Leo, I appreciate those thoughts, and I think that's part of the discussion that people are having in America and around the world. Zainab, one of the things I think about when I hear what Leo is saying, who makes those decisions? Who creates those moral and ethical boundaries?
I'm sorry, which boundaries?
who can create those moral and ethical boundaries, and who can control technology once it's out of the bag anyway?
Moral and ethical.
Right. Moral and ethical, excuse me.
Well, obviously, this is sort of how to deal with technology's consequences. You know, there's the social norms dimension. Sometimes you have legal dimensions. There are ways of designing these technologies so that they are more protective, especially of more vulnerable populations. I'm all for that. But on the other hand, I was just thinking as I was listening to the caller, you could make the same argument for, I don't know, the telephone. Before you're allowed to get a telephone, should we make people go through an evaluation on whether they can? You can make the same kind of argument over writing. Are you allowed to read books? So we have to kind of be careful, I think, between discussing how to design or use these technologies in ways that are more empowering for people and not necessarily design with the imperative just to make the most money. I totally agree with that, because sometimes financial considerations really misalign with human and social considerations, and that is a pity. But we can't really treat them like, oh, no, it's dangerous, and I'm not going to let you play with this, because there are major upsides. I mean, every time I talk with especially the kind of the generation who came of age as these spread, who are now in their 20s and started using it, and they can really they have distinct stories about how their lives improved in many ways. Yes, there were pitfalls and there were problems and sometimes clashes, but I also hear tons and tons of positive stories about not losing touch with, you know, friends from earlier stages, from high school, being able to be in touch with relatives that were, because it's you know, it's not just the technology. We also live lives that are evolving. So I'm just sort of wary of portraying them as some kind of evil invention with nothing but downsides. I think they also have empowered and opened windows and allowed all sorts of possibilities for vast numbers of people.
Now, we're running out of time, but so Dana, I do want to ask you this question, because along with Leo's question, I'm sure that we have listeners who are saying that they don't believe that using our current sex offender laws are too draconian, that if someone is 18 and they send a 14-year-old schoolmate a photo of their erect penis, that they should be prosecuted.
I think it's important to realize that it's a case-by-case basis, right? So there's different kinds of actions that we include under the whole umbrella of sexting, mm-hmm. some of which are about, you know, young people flirting with each other in ways that we would argue are relatively consensual, right? Mm-hmm. Which is, they're in a relationship, they're both sharing these photos, they believe in this, and then there's these moments of what happens when they break up and things go in all sorts of different directions.
Yeah, that's right.
The child pornography laws in the United States are set up for some of the most hideous crimes that exist in this country. And fundamentally, those pictures are photographic depictions of a sex crime against a minor, and they are fundamentally images that capture that crime. And what we really want to be cautious of is that we've set up these laws to make certain that the people who perpetrate such crimes against minors are prosecuted to the full extent of the law. And we have a whole slew of laws that are long-lasting around this, right? In a lot of countries, it means, you know, 25, or a lot of states, it means 25 or 30 years as a registered sex offender. It means the inability to get all sorts of different kinds of work. It means the inability to get loans. It means the inability to live within 100 yards of a school, library, or public place. It means the inability to see your children. And while we set these laws up because we really want to protect people from these violent acts against children, to prosecute a teenager who is being stupid under these laws will ruin their lives. Now, for the most part, prosecutors aren't going to that extent, and judges are not making those kinds of callings. But the possibility of this is there, and that's what makes a lot of it so terrifying. Because we can talk about wanting to teach a young person a lesson, right, and using the law that way, although I would argue that that's probably not the best of idea. But to guarantee a destruction of their life going forward is a totally different kind of scale. And I'm also worried that, you know, we don't want to devalue the child pornography laws. Because the child pornography laws are a very important tool to go after some of the most hideous crimes in this country.
It's also, I want to add to one thing she's saying, is that we are talking about how a teenage mistake, you know, may potentially follow this 13-year-old girl for maybe many years.
Right.
Hopefully it'll just disappear. You have to look on the other side, too, and realize even the kids who sort of distributed her pictures, they're also teenagers, and between 17 and 18, we may cross a legal line, perhaps, but, you know, it's still not the best approach to destroy people's lives over what are, in fact, fairly common teenage mistakes. And again, I do distinguish between the sort of the vile sort of crimes that are actually the kind of things that we should be draconian about, versus if you start threatening to ruin lives at the smallest misstep, even at the middle-sized misstep, it's,
yeah,
you're just doing the other side of what some of the effects of technology we're worried about, in which a smaller, medium-sized misstep becomes something that follows a young person for far longer than it should. So that's what I would add to that.
I do appreciate both of you taking this time in this first part of our program. Dr. Zeynep Tufekci, who just heard, assistant professor at UMBC in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology. Her blog is technosociology.org. And Dana Boyd is a fellow at the Harvard University's Beekman School for Internet and Society and a social media researcher at Microsoft. I thank you both so much for being with us, and we look forward to talking with you again soon.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you for inviting me, and thank you to Dr. Boyd. Bye.
Always. Thank you. And Anthony McCarthy and I will be right back. On the way there, let me remind you the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late, Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. When we come back, we'll be joined by Aaron Ryan of Jezebel.com and Susanna Stern, professor of communications at the University of San Diego, to continue this conversation and pick up where we left off. With your phone calls at 410-319-8888, has this made bullying, the whole sexting culture, more intense because of technology? And so it's in our face more. Does that change how we respond to it? We'll be right back. Stay with us. I'm Mark Steiner.
And I'm Anthony McCarthy.
And we welcome you back. We are continuing our conversation we started in the last hour. This time we are joined by Aaron Ryan, who's a writer for Jezebel.com, and Dr. Susanna Stern, Associate Professor of Communication Studies at the University of San Diego. And Aaron and Susanna, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Hi. Thank you. Hi.
410-319-8888 is the number here to join in on this conversation. We talked earlier in the hour to Zeynep Tufekci and Dana Boyd about this whole subject of sexting, of the power of Facebook and this digital communication and what it does. Whether it really clearly, the argument the last half an hour was, it does not change human behavior. The human behavior is always what it is. It just twists human behavior in terms of the use of the technology, because it goes farther, faster, and can really stay with you for the rest of your life, whatever you put up there. The question is, does that mean that we have to begin to change the way that we raise our children, to change the laws that govern these things? I mean, you wrote a bit about that, I think, Aaron, in your blog, if I remember correctly.
I did.
Yes. So let me start with you.
In terms of whether or not we need to change the way that we're raising children, I think that parents kind of form the basis of a child's perception of culture and what's expected of them. And one thing that I wrote about was that at the root of this whole phenomenon, it is a cultural pressure and expectation that teenagers will be sexual, and that they're valuable insofar as that they are sexual. And a parent can kind of head that off at the pass and try to instill in their children a sense of self-worth that isn't based around being an aesthetic consumable, especially in the case of young women. Young women, young girls, are told that they are valuable in so much as they're sexy. You're sexy, and the worst thing you can call a woman is fat or ugly, and not dumb. you know, a woman is in general is far more insulted by being called ugly than she is being called dumb. And I feel like that's an expression of a culture that's detrimental to the development of our young girls.
So do you think that if it's inherent, Susanna Stern, in our culture and in cultures in general, these are sexist cultures, so that if you want boys send certain nude photos over the internet, they're studs.
Yeah, right? Mark, I agree. I think we see it so differently.
Girls send it, and as someone wrote in the New York Times piece, if you're straight and male, you're a stud if you send it. But if you are a woman, then you are everything that is demeaned sexually in our society. Does the nature of that technology alter that, enhance it, change it in ways we can't think of, or is it just another tool in the sexist culture that we have?
I would probably say the latter. I think that, you know, the double standard has existed, unfortunately, for a long time, and now this technology, it sounds like what you talked about the first half of the show, is how much the double standard, if you will, these images can travel faster to more people and without necessarily recognizing the ramifications by the people who send them. And I think it's the technology that is enabling an age-old practice of exploring sexuality, of exploring relationships and power within relationships. But unfortunately, I think it's hard for anyone, teenagers and adults, to necessarily anticipate the ramifications.
Well, this is Anthony McCarthy. I'm curious, Aaron, about some of the stuff Mark and we were reading in preparation for the show about how young people view their relationships on a social medium like Facebook and how it impacts them when someone unfriends them on Facebook. Or that if someone points out they have a huge number of friends and you only have a certain number of friends, it's almost the same kind of bullying that we used to do in the classroom.
Oh, absolutely it is. Absolutely it is. I think I fall age-wise kind of on the cusp between young people that are going through their teenager years in this kind of age of information exchange and social media and adults that look back on it and think, oh, my goodness, thank goodness I missed that. because Facebook came into being when I was a senior in college. And so I was spared the stress of losing friends, of not having perceived online popularity, that young kids now are subjected to on a daily basis. And I think it definitely impacts their self-esteem. People interact with each other over the computer. It's the primary medium for interacting now at this point, especially for young people. And everybody can see who your friends are. That's another thing about Facebook that's a little bit different than normal or I guess how social interactions were in the past. Everybody can see. Your private life is public now. People can see when your friends write on your wall, and they can assume certain things about your relationship with those people based on what they wrote. You know, it's a little bit of marking your territory, and you can see, I've witnessed drama between people based on Facebook posts and some romantic jealousy based on what one person posted on someone's wall, and everyone's in a tizzy, and it's very strange because people's lives that were once private are now public, and everybody can see it.
And these folks, I guess the more interesting part is, they're not the typical celebrities of our society that we crave to know about their private lives. This is our neighbors, our friends, our classmates, and we are actually subject to their daily dramas, interactions with boyfriends or girlfriends or other relationships between friends. And I know, having experienced this and watching my friends have what I would call hissy fits on Facebook or battles on Facebook, we follow it. It's a very different level of intimacy that we have with each other.
Right. It's combination intimacy and what I think could be referred to almost as micro-celebrity, because people are paying attention to your movements in a way that people weren't before, and you're aware that other people are paying attention to what you're doing, so it's a really strange awareness that you're being watched, but you're simultaneously watching, which I think kind of, if you're a teenager, that can really mess with your head.
So the question is then, and 410-319-8888 is the number here, and I want to think what you think as young people out there or as parents out there about this. I mean, does this technology change the way we react to what we would have reacted, how we reacted before the technology? In other words, if somebody posts something about me or anybody on Facebook and it's derogatory and it goes out to hundreds of people instantly, and then you have to walk into school and face that, or walk into your place of work and face that, is that different than the way we were bullied? Some people were bullied. I guess when I was a little boy, I was one of those kids because, you know, you're a little off, not quite like everybody else. You're or kind of taunted. But that you have a haven. Does this take away the haven? Does it change how we react to it? Does it change how we as a society have to react to what has happened to them? Does it change the dynamic at all, do you think, Susanna?
Yes, Susanna.
Hi, I have a few things I just want to respond to that have been coming up. A few things. One, I
please.
Think there's no doubt that things are different, that there is an obligation, a social obligation now for children, teenagers, even more so, to be online, to have a public presence. But I think there's a few things that need to enter into this conversation. One, and I think you and the other speaker allude to the idea that there's a lot of work involved now in friendship management, relationship management, that has become complicated by this technology, things like status updates and friends and so forth. So I think that's one component that's made maybe life a little bit more challenging, and I think the other speaker alluded to this, you know, thank God we didn't have it when we were younger, that kind of thing. So there's that portion of identity work, if you will. It's more work now to figure out not only who you are, but how you want to present yourself
right.
to other people. And so that's a second component, is this notion of, you know, it's not just that we're seeing teenagers hash out their lives online, because they are actually thinking about what they're putting up there oftentimes. So it's a representation of self that oftentimes is strategic, sometimes impulsive as well. But I think that's important too, is that they're oftentimes thinking about how they want others to perceive them. The third thing I wanted to say, and this is something I'm researching right now, is, you know, it's very easy to frame all these instances of teenagers putting things up that they regret as problematic. But what we're not thinking about, too, is there's a lot of trial and error that occurs during adolescence.
Yes.
And there's a lot of learning that is taking place from young people who have situations that they lose friends, or there's mix-ups, or, you know, we often hear of the very extreme instances, like the New York Times article about, you know, a girl who is essentially ostracized by her entire, you know, community. But more often than not, these things happen at a smaller scale, and they learn from them and they don't do them again. They extrapolate lessons from them. And my research is certainly bearing out this idea that, you know, regretful experiences online can have a very positive effect in terms of social learning. So I think there's an important component to recognize that it's not always bad when something bad happens. Oftentimes something very good can come out of it. And I think that's one of the things that we need to work on as adults and parents, is helping young people anticipate what might happen, but when they do happen, help them work through it, help them take some lesson away from it. So I just wanted to include that as part of the conversation.
No, that's deeply important. And let me open the phones here, 410-319-8888. Anthony McCarthy, of course, is Monday. He's here with us in the studio. We are joined by phone by right now, Susanna Stern, Associate Professor of Communication Studies at the University of San Diego, Aaron Ryan, writer for JezebelCom. And David, you're on the air. David, you're on the air. Hi, David.
Hi. How you doing?
Welcome.
I have a couple of points. One, your guest just stated it's a good learning experience, or you can take something positive. I have a teenage child that has some negativity posted about them on Facebook, and they did bring me into it. And we sat down and talked, and hopefully the conversation did ease their feelings about the situation. But my other point is, I think the definition of bullying has expanded or changed. You know, I'm kind of old school, and when I grew up, bullying was more physical. And, you know, we talked about each other. We played the dozen, so to speak, or the Joneses, as some people call it. But we did that. And sometimes you were offended and you took it the wrong way, but bullying was always considered something physical. Some guys picking on me and they take my money every day or something to that nature. And just personally, I think kids are maybe overly coddled now and overly sensitive.
That's an interesting point. Any comments here from Anthony or our guests?
Well, I find it fascinating. I have a nephew who I just adore. He is so bright and one of the top wrestlers in the state of Virginia. Recently, when I went home and our family went out to dinner, he did not take his face away from his phone.
Right.
And he was texting the entire time. He was so socially disengaged with his family that he didn't participate in the conversation. And then what I guess I found more disturbing, Mark, was that none of us minded. No one said to him, you need to put your phone down and engage in this conversation. It was almost accepted that he's part of a new generation where being plugged into technology is part of his socialization, and that's what he was doing. I found it very disturbing, but didn't want to break any family taboos by saying, why are you on that phone the entire time we're eating dinner? And I think that too many of us, as the caller said, I think too many of us just now allow young people to have fewer boundaries than we had, Mark, when we were younger because of technology.
Because of technology? Erin.
I wrote a little bit about this. I wrote a little bit about this. I think it's very interesting that nowhere in the discussion or in very few cases in the discussion is it brought up that parents are allowing their children to have their cell phones all the time and to be on them all the time, like you said, Anthony. One thing that stuck out to me in the New York Times article was a reflective statement by the father of the girl that had sent the original photo that was forwarded a million times and ended up being socially ostracized. And her father said, I shouldn't have trusted her so much. Mm. Teenagers aren't adults. I'm barely an adult. But teenagers are especially not adults. And it's not a parent's job to be their kid's friend. Your adult judgment is going to be better and better informed than their kid judgment. And sometimes your judgment is going to have to trump their judgment. And sometimes that's going to make them mad, and sometimes they're going to slam doors on you and tell you that they hate you. But that's what being a parent to a teenager is. It's setting up boundaries. It's telling your kids no sometimes. And I think that that's something that's left out of the discussion. Not that parents should so isolate their children from technology that the kids can't relate to their peers, but that there needs to be boundaries that are drawn by parents, and that's not society's job.
How do we do that, Susanna, in this new world for our children? Draw those kinds of boundaries where our children aren't on Facebook until after midnight, after they've done their homework, but they're socializing on their laptop, and we think they're asleep, but they're carrying on in a whole new world.
Yeah, I agree that there need to be rules and parameters, and that is very hard. I mean, I have a 3-year-old son, and just getting him – you know, not to watch television all the time. I mean, we have rules. You know, you can watch 30 minutes a day, and you have to stick with them. You have to be consistent. And I think the same things can apply with the computer and with phone, that, you know, you check your phone in at the door kind of policy, and there's rules about when you use them, and they're enforced. And so I think that is a really important part of what's going on with any media, not just cell phones, is that there need to be boundaries, that young people know that there's a time and a place, and they know what they are, and they know what the ramifications are if they violate those boundaries. You started out the half hour talking about if we need to change the way we raise children. So that's one component of it, is setting these rules and parameters.
Mm-hmm.
The other part, I think, is having conversations about how to act ethically in these digital spaces. And that's a new conversation. We didn't used to have to say that. But, you know, as I tell my son, he's 3 years old, you know, when someone smiles at you, Julian, it's nice if you smile back. We also, you know, or it's not nice to growl at people. That's what he wants to say. You know,
let's go. Are y'all still there?
Me?
Yeah, I thought we just lost the mic for a minute. Let me go back to the phones here, 410-319-8888. And Sherry, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, Sherry.
I'm a parent of four, actually. I'm a young parent. I'm not. I had my son when I was in my oldest child when I was 18 years old through disobedience. I mean, I was a single parent. I'm still a single parent. And I have a 14-year-old daughter and two younger, not, 10 and 11-year-old. So I have my hands full. But the rules of the house are you don't get a Facebook page. You don't get a cell phone. You don't sit in the front of my car until you're over the age of 13. And my son is the only one in the house other than me with the Facebook page. And I was hearing how restrictions are not a normal thing for young parents anymore. I noticed, like, 11-year-olds walking around with cell phones and texting. And I was listening about the nephew who was texting during dinner or whatever. And that's a no-no in my house. He has no phone zone. If we're having family night, if we're having dinner or lunch together as a family, I cannot use my phone. I tell my friends and family, do not call me, do not try to socialize and get in contact with me, because my children and I are spending family time together, and every dinner that we sit down together, the phones are either turned off or put away or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have, the value of families being together is not a big thing in this day and age. It's easy for teenagers to get caught up in Facebook or other mediums to embarrass themselves, because you're right, the parents are laxing on what you should. You're becoming a young adult. You shouldn't say those things. You shouldn't do certain things. Not too many parents are doing that anymore. They're just allowing teenagers so that they can be their best friend. And I've told my children, rule number one, I am not your friend. I never will be your friend. You have enough friends in school, and I don't need a 16-year-old as my friend. So don't.
Sherry.
Oh, I mean, you're not even to my intellectual level yet, so you don't know how to even discuss adult things. How can I make you my friend? I need to be your disciplinarian. So that's my point of view on that. I think you need to break. I call it bring down the hammer on some of this stuff.
Sherry, we're close to out of time. I do appreciate your comments here on the air with us. And one thing we did not have a chance to do, we only have a few minutes left, which is a shame because I wanted to raise this question earlier. It seems to also be changing our laws, because now we want to put bullies, people we call bullies and others who exchange pictures, in jail or prosecute them in some states. And that is changing the nature of how we respond to this, I think, anyhow. Susanna?
Yeah, I think the legal issue is oftentimes why these stories get catapulted into the news media.
Right.
I don't believe that's the way to go. I don't think that when these situations happen, I mean, even as this New York Times article, explains, no one thought of what they were doing as the kind of crime that they were eventually, charged with. So I just think that's just the wrong way to go. We can't legislate human behavior. We can't criminalize normal teen behavior. I mean, the quote I had in the Times article today talks about this idea that, young people are simply trying to practice how to manage friendships, relationships, self-expression in a heavily mediated, heavily sexualized, world that we have today. So to criminalize their behavior for doing something they see happen in all these other spaces and places just, to me, makes no sense and seems very counterproductive.
Now, we don't have time for this today, unfortunately, but what you just raised, Susanna, is something I think that deserves a huge discussion, which is the intersection of the heightened sexuality of the world we live in today and the intensity of the technology. And when those two converge, I think it does change the human dynamic in ways we're only beginning to kind of wrestle with. And I wish they were telling me I have 1 minute left, and that's not a good time to raise an intensive to that up. So well, I'll do that for the next time. I do appreciate you both taking time with us and with our listeners. And Susanna Stern and Aaron Ryan, I hope that you will both join us again.
Oh, thank you for having us.
Thank you so much. And they and our other guests, all their information, all the things they've written, the work they're doing, will be linked to on our web. And we'll be right back. After this little break, on the way to break, let me remind you that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com, or you can go to steinershow.org and click on their banner. The information is there as well. Anthony McCarthy and I will be right back.